Mreichtuden.
Mreichtuden.
Sober as... Sober... Sober... Sober as...
Welcome to the Anonymous Eskimo Project, a program devoted to bringing hope to those struggling with mental health issues and addiction. Through candid conversations with guests about mental health issues, addiction, and sobriety, we can let those who are struggling know that they are not alone. I am your host, Ralph Sara. On this show, I have Clarissa Larson. Clarissa is Alaskan native from Dillingham, Alaska. She has been sober since June 6th of 2020. On this episode, Clarissa courageously shares her story for those who are still struggling. This show is very powerful. Clarissa is such a strong, courageous woman that tackles very hard to talk about issues of addiction and mental health. So guys, please help me welcome Clarissa Larson. Hi, Clarissa. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself so everybody can get to know you?
So my name's Clarissa. I'm Alaska native from Dillingham, Alaska. I'm 29 years old. And right now I'm a stay-at-home mom, and my recovery date is June 6th of 2020.
Wow, right when the pandemic hit, huh?
Yeah, so I had went to treatment in 2019, February, and then like a year later, I was holding on to my alcohol and marijuana, you know, and didn't want to let that go, and so I was drinking a little bit, but it got to a point where I was like, I started off with like a bottle of wine. It would take me a couple weeks to finish it, you know, just sipping a little bit here and there. And then all of a sudden, like a month after I started drinking, I started drinking like a bottle a day. And then I was drinking like noon, starting at noon before my daughter would even get off of the bus. And when that started happening, I was like, oh man, I really need to look at my problem with alcohol too, because it was always my one thing I would hold on to, you know. I didn't want to let it go.
Yeah, me too. I would, you know, want to be sober and want to show everybody that, you know, I could be sober. But I always found a reason to why I could drink, you know. It could be I could start an argument or something with my significant other, or need some way to celebrate, or, you know, mourn somebody's passing or anything, you know. Mm-hmm. I always found an excuse.
Yeah, for sure. My thing was like, oh, well, when I stopped using drugs, I wasn't drinking at all, so I don't have a problem with booze. Like, when the treatment center told me I had a problem with alcohol, I was like, what? What are you talking about? Like, drugs are my thing, you know. I never had a problem with alcohol. But when I really started looking at it this last time, I looked at my high school. I started drinking in middle school. And by the time I was in high school, I was drinking like every weekend and smoking pot every day, all day long. When I looked at that, I was like, you know, I really do need to think about this and realize that it is an issue for me, and it's better off that I don't do it. So my sober date, yeah, is June 6th of 2020, because I quit drinking before that. I didn't know the exact day, so I kind of just picked a day, and I was thinking, oh, well, I'll just always remember 6-6-2020. It's pretty easy. And I know I wasn't drinking after that time, so...
Yeah, when I went to treatment this last time, I was in treatment too, probably around the same time as you, because I was in treatment in, when was it? Man, I always get the dates wrong. But it was in the pandemic, yeah. But I was like you, I had to change my date because in treatment, everybody was saying, okay, what's your date or your sobriety date? And I picked it, I think I was like December 24th or something like that. And then I remembered, oh man, I drank that one time. And so I had to change it to January 18th. So it's funny how people, you know, cling on to those dates, but then sometimes in our midst of our drinking, we forget about things.
Yeah. There was a few times where, I've gotten sober a few different times. And so it's always like hard to explain when you go as far back as like the first time I got sober versus the last time I got sober. And it was a totally different experience. The first time I got sober was in 2015. I was pregnant with my daughter. I was about 7 months pregnant when I finally got the courage to go to the hospital because I was so ashamed and I felt so guilty. And it was almost like the further I went, the harder it was to go and reach out for help because I felt like I was going to be judged. And it just felt really shameful. And so that was the first time I got sober. And then when my daughter was about a year and a half, I relapsed and went back out for another couple years. And so the last time I got sober was in 2019, and then I kind of drank after that. So, but I used to do heroin and meth. And this last time was probably the hardest it ever was to get sober for me.
Yeah, that you talk about shame, and man, that shame is so crippling to people. You know, people can live their whole lives without, you know, talking about something, or because it was taught to them not to say anything, something that hurt them or something that happened in their when they were growing up, or even when they were drinking, you know, you don't want to think about that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And some people, especially Native communities, Native people were taught, you know, not to talk. Mm-hmm. Don't talk about that kind of stuff because that's shameful. And if you let that shame encompass you, it's like you're in your own jail cell, I would kind of say, you know, because it's a crippling thing to go through, and you could just stay in one place for a very, very long time. I know when I went into treatment, this time around, I actually talked to a clinician, and I was able to talk about things in a safe place with a safe person, you know, just because before I always thought, oh man, what if they tell somebody, or what if this gets out or something like that? Just stupid things in my head that I would be thinking of. But I actually tried and talked to somebody this time around in treatment, and they, you know, they had it in closed doors, and they even had a white noise machine outside of the door so other people couldn't hear. So I felt really safe to be able to talk about these things, you know, that were bothering me inside. And once I was able to get that out, it seemed like I was able to start working on myself, you know.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of, so this last time I went to treatment, I've been to treatment 3 or 4 different times. And so I went to Pennsylvania in February of 2019, and it was almost like a culture shock. Everybody was like, oh, you're so different, you're from Alaska. And I was like, I'm just here to get sober, you know, I'm not here to like stand out or and so when I got there, I had been doing heroin and meth, and I had to kind of come down from it a little bit before I could get any medications. They like you to wait so much time before you can take Suboxone and stuff. And so, you know, I was really sick those first couple of days. I had dental problems. I had really bad teeth and I was in a lot of pain. And then when they started me on the Suboxone, I was doing really good. But when I stopped taking it, because they tapered me off pretty quickly, within like 2 weeks I was done taking it, I had went into like a psychosis. And I was paranoid. I was having delusions. I didn't really know what was going on. And to this day, I even question the reality of what was going on there. And I don't think they were really trained to see the severity of my mental state at that time. So they were just kind of thinking that I was being manipulative because I wanted to go home. And it was really hard to trust people there, so I didn't really open up. And then it was like this crazy story. So when I was trying to leave that treatment facility, I actually tried to run away in the middle of the night because they would let us go out to smoke. I could not sleep with the time difference and coming down off of the drugs. I tried to run away and it was really cold there. And this guy ran after me and was like, "Where are you going? You know, you don't even have your wallet or any money. Like, what are you going to do?" And so he talked me back into going back there. And then I moved to a recovery house and I was still having paranoia. Like, there was a TV in my room and it had this red light on it. And I kept thinking to myself, like, they're watching me through that red light. Like, there's a camera in that TV. Because the TV was never turned on. It was just there, and we never used it. So I'm, like, fake sleeping. It was really crazy. So I tried to run away from that place. And then at that time, I think they were kind of like, okay, we should probably just let her go home. Because she keeps trying to run away. We can't, you know, catch up with her every time. She's going to get away eventually. So my uncle came to pick me up in Pennsylvania. We flew to Chicago. We had a layover there. And I ran away from him at the airport. I went to this gas station and bought a pack of cigarettes. But at the airport, the cab driver wouldn't even take me because he was like, "Where's your parents?" And I was like 26 or 25 at the time. And they kept thinking I was a minor because I was like 110 pounds at that time. And I showed him my ID and the security, airport security, my ID, and was like, "Look, I'm an adult." And so he took me to the gas station. I bought cigarettes. I went and sat in the street. And this treatment center that I was at kept telling me, "If you choose to leave and you don't go to our aftercare facility, you're going to be homeless. Your dad's not going to pay your ticket home. We're not going to give you your clothes or your belongings, your ID, your debit card, none of that. So you're just going to be on the streets all by yourself." So here I am in Chicago on the streets thinking that this is going to be my life. I was literally sitting on the sidewalk and I'm like, I'm homeless now because I chose to run away and do all that. And this old couple walked by and this old man was like shaking his finger at me, you know, like, piss, like, "You shouldn't be here. What are you doing?" He didn't say anything, but he just, the way he was doing his finger like that, I was like, and to this day, I also question, was that real? Like, was that a real person walking by or was I hallucinating it? Or I don't know, but like now I think of it as, man, that guy was really an angel. So my uncle found me. We got on the plane. And then on the plane, I freaked out and was like thinking that the plane was going to crash for some reason. It's probably from the trauma of my mom's death. She passed away when I was 8 in a plane crash. And so here I'm thinking, oh, this plane's going to crash. I really need to get off. So I freaked out, told them to let me off the plane. They put me in an ambulance and brought me straight to the hospital. And that was when I finally started getting help for my psychosis. I was put into Chicago Behavioral Health for, I think, 2 weeks. And in a weird way, I felt like I was safe and I belonged there with people that were like me, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad and them came down and got me from Chicago and brought me home. And I was supposed to do therapy, and I would go to therapy and I would not talk. And I would go to all these doctor's appointments and I wouldn't talk to them. I didn't trust them to share all these traumas and stuff that I'd been suppressing the whole time I was using, you know. And so they quit. But a funny story, at therapy, I thought, I didn't want to talk because I thought there was police in the other room listening to our conversation. And then I also thought they were broadcasting it on KDLG, like a live broadcast. This is how bad and severe my psychosis was. And that lasted for probably 3 or 4 months of paranoia, delusions, hallucinations. I had a really hard time socializing with people. And I don't want to like share this to scare people from getting sober. This is just my experience, you know.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think about it now. And I have kind of been putting the timeline together of when this was all happening. And I recently requested my medical records from the hospital here to kind of see what medications I was taking, what didn't work, how many times I was hospitalized. After I came home, there was 2 times where I had major depression. So they had given me antidepressants and they actually didn't work. It was like the opposite effect. I became suicidal. So I was actually hospitalized twice for suicide watch. And that was like the first time in my life that I had ever thought that way. And it was really scary. That was a really scary time in my life. And then I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So here I had this dual diagnosis. And when I got that diagnosis of bipolar disorder, I was devastated. I thought it meant that my life was over, that I would never have a good life. And I think it's just the stigma of what you hear and think about any kind of mental disorders when you're growing up, what you see on TV, how the media and news portrays it, like you're this terrible person or something. And
yeah,
it was really hard for me to accept it. I was like, no way, this is not right. And then I started going to therapy and actually talking to my therapist. And how you were saying, like, it's a safe place. It's so freeing to have a safe place where you know it's not going to be talked about in the community. And somebody that's able to take on that, because sometimes even talking to family members or friends, it's heavy to hold somebody's secrets, or when someone's telling you these things, it's hard to receive it and even not be judgmental. Even if you love the person, you're kind of like, whoa, she's a little wacko, you know? having that safe place for me, I've been doing therapy for a little over a year now, and it's helping me so much with all of the trauma that I suppress. And growing up, after my mom passed away, we were kind of told, like, you have to be strong. Don't let people see you cry. You know, go in your room and cry. So I suppressed all that sadness. And then it came out as anger. So people were always walking on eggshells around me, like, my whole life growing up. And then it wasn't, like, I wasn't a really fun person to be around because I was always angry. And I think the only way for me to express my grief in a strong way was through anger, because anger is seen as, like, oh, you're really strong, you're so angry. Not crying, you know.
Mm-hmm. Man, you touched on so much, so many issues that, man, I'm really intrigued in your story.
Yeah, I feel like I could write a book. I was just telling my dad the other night, I think I'm going to try write a book.
Yeah, do
it. It's also good to get things out, even writing it on paper. I do a lot of journaling, talking with my therapist. I have a sponsor. Getting all these things out. So that's basically what I've been doing the last couple of years since I got sober, is taking all the trauma that I've stored in myself and letting it out. And it takes away the power of it. And it's not like I can think of things that still, you know, hurt my feelings or make me sad or make me mad, but it's a lot easier to control that emotion, and it doesn't feel so overwhelming once you get it out there and, you know, sort through it. It's a lot easier. So thanks for therapy.
How would you encourage somebody that maybe is still going through it, and somebody like you that were in the past, how would you encourage them?
I would say there's people that love you, and it's never too late. Every day is an opportunity to change, even in a small way, through harm reduction or going to treatment. Every day that you're alive, you have a chance to reach out for help. So don't give up.
Yeah, so we are living proof, man. I went to two other different treatments before this last residential treatment. But before that, I even went to, you know, outpatient treatment because I was court ordered, you know. And but all those times I never worked and told people what I was, you know, ashamed of or anything like that. You know, I was too ashamed. I was too ashamed to talk. But this last time I opened up to a clinician, and, you know, just being the here right now, telling your story, is showing people not to give up, you know, and that they're not alone. There's people that are too ashamed to even think about it, you know. They're just numbing themselves. So I really, really want to thank you for having the courage to come on here and share your story. Man, it really blew me away.
It kind of just made me think of something one of the counselors in Pennsylvania told me, and I have had, like, a little stash at home for when I got home, and I told him about it, and he goes, you know what we call that? A reservation. And I never heard of that word in regards to recovery, but in 2015, when I got sober, I did have reservations. Like, I even told myself, okay, I'm going to get sober till my daughter turns 18, and then I can do whatever the hell I want. So for the next 18 years, I'm going to stick it out. That's how bad my reservations were. I'm like, I'm just going to, because OCS was involved. And I was like, I'm going to get OCS off my back. So I'm going to do this treatment, and then I can do whatever I want, you know. So I think even if you go into recovery with reservations, you can always work through them. So it's okay to have reservations. Like me telling myself, oh, I'm gonna stay sober till my daughter turns 18. It got me somewhere. And it gave me that little cushion to think, okay, in 18 years I can do this, so I'm going to do what I need to do now. And I learned a lot, and then I relapsed, and then I learned some more. And I feel like today I don't have any reservations anymore because, I don't know, I just tell myself no problem in the world is ever going to get fixed by me using drugs or alcohol. Like, it's still going to be there after that. So.
Yeah. Yeah, all the pain and all the hurt is not going to disappear because you're drinking or using drugs. It's always going to be there, and it's always going to rear its ugly head. I don't want to be like that anymore.
I kind of told my therapist one day, I was just a few weeks ago, or October 10th was my mom's anniversary of her death. And a couple of days before that, I was crying. And I didn't even feel safe to cry in my own house. I actually got in my car because I was like, oh, my daughter's going to see me or my boyfriend's going to see me and they're going to ask me what's wrong and I don't want to talk about it. So I got in my car and I drove to the boat harbor and I was just sitting there watching the water and crying. And even the thought 2 years later was like, I really wish I could get high right now. And then immediately I was like, no, I don't want to get high right now. So I was talking to my therapist about it, and I said, I'm never going to use drugs again. And she goes, how does that make you feel? I said, you know, they always say that. How does that make me feel? It feels like a lie coming out of my mouth. Like, it still feels like a lie to this day. But, I worked through those reservations too. And I even had one like, oh, if a family member passed away, it would be like a good excuse to use. So I got rid of those, and I'm like, no matter what. I heard this at another meeting too. This guy goes, I'm a part of the no matter what club, and I'm thinking, what is that? Like, what does he mean? And he said, no matter what, I'm not going to drink. And I was like, ooh, I want to be part of that club too.
Clarissa, thank you so, so much for having the courage to come on here and tell your story. Holy cow, one of the most powerful ones.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was an honor to be on here.
Well, that's all for today's show. I hope you, the listeners, found some inspiration, strength, and hope. Listen next week when I have another strong, courageous person on who's walking with us on this healing journey. This program is available as a podcast. You can hear this and many more episodes wherever you listen to podcasts or at anonymouseskimo.com. Join in the Anonymous Eskimo Project, Saturdays at 3 p.m., Sundays at 8 p.m. on KSKO, serving the western interior of Alaska for more than four decades. I'm your host, Ralph Sara. Biura!
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.